Hello, welcome to 8.9 Newsweek. I'm Finn Locustain. Our Newsweek podcast brings together a collection of audio from recent 8.9 video interviews. If you want to watch instead of listen, then please visit our website at 8.9.com and click on the TV tab. Four conversations today. First, I'll meet David Wright, the chief executive of Ecometric, to find out exactly how soil carbon is measured. Then after that, I'll talk to Chris de Gorn from Life to Land about an analysis that shows that the non-native sycamore is now the UK's third most populous tree species. Later, I'll discuss the benefits of having more trees on farms with Hugh Evans from Three Pools, and we'll round up the programme with a conversation about the Westminster government's proposals for mandatory method of production labelling with Peter Stevenson and Catherine Jadoff from Compassion in World Farming. Right, let's get started. The ability to unlock tradable soil carbon credits depends on the accurate measurement, reporting and verification of soil carbon stocks. Ecometric uses a combination of baseline soil sampling, satellite imagery and artificial intelligence, and Ecometric's chief executive is David Wright. I asked him to explain the company's approach to soil carbon assessments.
So soil carbon is by its nature very variable in space, and that relates to soil types and how the land's been historically managed. So you cannot avoid the need to take soil samples and directly analyse those for carbon content in the lab. So specifically using dry combustion dew mass test, which combusts at a very high temperature, measures the percentage of carbon dioxide coming off the sample, and that's related to the organic carbon content, having removed the inorganic carbon content before it goes into the lab. So the dense soil sampling, the design of your soil sampling needs to capture the spatial variability, and then the laboratory analysis needs to directly measure both soil organic carbon and bulk density. And if stone content is significant, that also needs to be measured as a stone fraction to deduct.
Now, you talked there about using soil cores direct from the field, but you're also using AI remote sensing. I wonder how this works to build a better picture for you.
In sort of statistical terms, if you are trying to sample a very varied population, to get as close as possible to the true answer, you have to take as many samples as possible. So what spectral analysis, in addition to the soil sampling, does is it gives us access to a different type of sample. It's still dynamic, it's still directly related to the site, multi-temporally. So we take soil samples and directly measure them in the laboratory. We also take coincident spectral samples. So the reflected light bands received by a multispectral satellite sensor, and we harvest the raw pixel values. So from, if you imagine one particular point in space, we have a soil sample result where the laboratory reports the accurate soil carbon content from direct measurement. And then we have the reflected pixel values measured from space. And the artificial intelligence system processes both of those, one as input, one as output, and it finds the relationship between the two. Once it's done that, which you can do with uncanny accuracy, so we get to above 95% relative accuracy between the two. So when I mean relative in its literal sense, relating one directly to the other, so comparing. Once it's achieved those accuracy levels through its training and testing process, the reflected light becomes a proxy for carbon, and it allows the AI system to estimate carbon values between the soil sample results and indeed beyond them. So in effect, it gives us access to a lot more sample information, raising the statistical confidence in the field total being as close as we can get it to the true average. And then over time, as the AI system learns on each sample, it's a specific type of artificial intelligence we're using called neural networks. They learn iteratively on every set of data that we give them, and they improve. Then we can slowly, in an evidenced way, drive down the number of physical soil samples over time to reduce the cost of this monitoring process, which is very important when you consider the scalability, but also being able to repeat it multi-temporally at a shorter interval. Because what we want to do ideally is monitor change annually so that we can relate that change to the management practices that caused it.
So you're using AI and satellite imagery to speed up and simplify the process, but at the same time, you're also taking lots of direct samples. Could you just talk me through the soil samples? How many do you expect to take in an average hectare, and to what extent does this change depending on the land variability?
And that's very good that you've highlighted the variability there. So we need to have some indication of the inherent variability, so we'll do do pre-sampling if we're unsure. We also take soil series information, so available data sets. So if we have high variability, we need to increase the sampling density. When we will take a sample per hectare, we aggregate samples, so each sample consists of multiple cores. So if you imagine what we're trying to get from the laboratory is a result which is representative of the true average of that hectare block. So firstly, we don't stratify the fields based on a proxy for carbon because we've tested all the accepted proxies for carbon and not found the relationship that's suggested. So others have used electrical conductivity or soil series or NDVI even to assume how the carbon is distributed spatially. We've tested all of those and not found that they work. So we apply a grid sampling. It's called compact geographic stratification. That avoids any bias, because if you use a stratification that isn't directly related to the carbon, you've introduced bias. So we overlay a grid on the field, and the highest density we do is one sample per hectare, and we will take 10 cores from that hectare, which are then aggregated into a single sample. And the important part is we maintain the core density. So if we have low variability, the grid size can increase up to a maximum of 4 hectares, but the core density stays the same. So we will then be gathering 40 cores in that 4-hectare block. And that ensures that that result we get back from the laboratory accurately reflects the true average of that grid square.
Interesting. Now, I understand that you've been sampling to a depth of 30 centimetres up until now, but that you're considering sampling deeper underground. Why is that?
So we've been taking some R&D deep samples all the way through. So the top 30 centimetres is driven by a few reasons. Firstly, cost to sample deeper is more expensive. Secondly, the carbon markets, if we're thinking about turning soil organic carbon gains into revenue from credits, only expect the top 30 centimetres. So we can sample to that depth and therefore limit cost, and that's acceptable to the carbon markets. But what we found over time, and it's also conservative because we know that we get gains deeper than 30 centimetres. So if we're only accounting for the gains in the top 30 centimetres, we're being conservative, which is actually the reason the carbon markets have accepted 30, because they want the highest level of conservatism. However, we want to understand from an R&D perspective, and particularly because we're relating our results back to the agronomic practices which caused the change, we want to understand how the carbon moves down through the profile. So the assumption from a lot of soil science is that we will saturate the top 30 centimetres. It will reach an equilibrium state. And we want to know if when that saturation occurs in the top 30 centimetres, we're still able to sequester carbon at deeper levels, or it's moving down through the structure in a vertical sense.
And I guess the follow-up question is, why stop at a metre? Is this to do with the rooting depth of the plants that you expect to find?
Yeah, so 30 centimetres was largely believed to be important because that's the bit that we are interfering with in the management of our crop. Cultivation implements rarely go deeper, but rooting systems, of course, do. And it's the rooting systems and exudates going out of those roots and the microbiome that's all converting organic matter into organic carbon. So we've got to start to understand that from a soil science perspective. What's really interesting with what we're doing, though, is, and we are challenging quite a few of the preconceived assumptions by soil science, which tended to do its testing in small, highly concentrated areas, whereas we're doing our testing over very wide areas, but still with a high degree of sampling density. And when you overlay the AI and the spectral sampling as well, we're getting statistically significant indications of how management practices are changing carbon at a short time interval in that top 30 centimetres. So the next stage is to understand what it's doing to 30 to 60, 60 to 90. And what we're seeing roughly is an equivalence in the carbon stock from 30 to 60 centimetres, as in the top 30 centimetres, and then it starts to decline from 60 to 90. But it's a very good question. You know, sometimes we're limited with shallow soils that aren't 30 centimetres deep. So in the UK, in the Cotswolds, so chalky brash soils over chalk bedrock may not be 30 centimetres deep. So when we're converting soil organic carbon percentage into a quantity, we of course need to know how deep the soil is, because that's the multiple, the depth of the sample that starts to turn it into a quantity. Mm-hmm. And a meter depth, or 90 centimeters, as a lot of the sampling rigs limit at, again, is a pragmatic balance between how much hydraulic power you need to drive a corer to that depth versus how deep average soils are versus are we going to be able to manage carbon stock change at deeper levels? So we're working within, and the most difficult part of our job really is to balance that fine line between accuracy and affordability. Because we're wanting to work at scale to drive agricultural system change, that's our primary mission as a business, we have to make our service affordable. So much as we would like to sample at a higher density, we can't afford to because the projects can't afford to pay, and depth comes into that affordability equation.
When you're collecting repeat data from individual sites, do you find a fairly linear accrual in carbon stocks, or does it tend to vary substantially from season to season and from year to year?
Very variable. So no such thing as linear in nature, as you'll know well. So the best analogy I can describe is like the growth rings on a tree. You know, when we cut a tree down and you look at that, the different amount of carbon weight gain over a growing season, which is directly related to the meteorological conditions of that season, we find the same in agriculture. So if you think about it's the above and below ground biomass, which is through photosynthesis, removing atmospheric CO2, and through various processes, some of that ends up as soil organic carbon. So a good climatic year that has the right rainfall and sunlight balance at the right times of the year to support the growth stages will have the maximum sequestration potential. And likewise, on difficult years, this year, 2023 has almost been, or the 2023 season, we're sampling at the end. We always look back a year. So if we're sampling this winter, we're looking at what happened over the previous year. Has almost been a force majeure event in parts of the UK because we've had so much rain. So in the Midlands, where I'm based, we're sitting at about 200% of the 20-year average winter rainfall already. And that moves carbon. So again, you know, in terms of the assumption, for example, that regenerative agriculture would always add, the weather has a big part to play in that. And that's part of the really interesting relationship between cause and effect. So what's changed and what's caused it, that's the most interesting part of our job. So to find those agronomic and meteorological relationships.
And what is that change? Is there less sequestration this year? And also, are you finding a difference between regenerative and conventional farm systems?
Yeah, so there are some high-level factors which are becoming quite obvious. We're often asked by farmers, well, will this particular seed mix perform better than this particular seed mix? And we're stepping right back from being drawn to that level of detail because the natural system we're dealing with is simply too complex to really identify one cause. But from a high level, we're finding that regenerative agriculture as a system, and what I mean by that is to grow cover crops and catch crops in between cash crops. So we're maximizing the green canopy and the root biomass. So above and below ground biomass is maximized. Minimum soil disturbance and the reintroduction of livestock or at least organic amendments. Those systems are performing much better from a soil sequestration perspective. Excuse me. So conventional farming is still eroding its carbon stocks. We're seeing decline year on year. Regenerative farming is adding carbon to its stocks year on year. And the rate of change, so for both the conventional and the regen, depends on exact management and weather interaction. So, for example, this winter, we have seen some fields on some farms lose carbon. And that related in every case to the fact that they ended up through either design or by accident with bare soil over the winter. So because the first rainfall event hit in October, some people had not yet got their autumn crops established or their cover crops established. So they had no protection to the soil when the rain came. And then the ground became too wet to establish crops or to drill crops going forward. So those soils were unprotected. And the deluge that followed, you know, carbon moves, some of it's soluble, particulate can be moved, leached hydrologically down into the profile or out into the water course. So the water re-engineers that soil and it relates to soil structure and how much protection is on top. So timing is clearly a very big issue. So the really good regenerative farmers that got their cover crops in and established and their autumn crops in and established have still made gains. The ones that had bare soil have exposed those soils to potential losses.
That was David Wright from Ecometric. An analysis of 3 million species records by the new nature recovery portal Life to Land has revealed that the non-native sycamore has become the UK's third most common tree. Chris de Gorne, the founder of Life to Land, says that this underscores the alarming extent of Britain's biodiversity loss. I asked him why.
So in the UK, when we're usually talking about rewilding, we're talking about nature restoration, we usually start from the point of view of where are our ecosystems right now, and where do they used to be? And if we look at sort of the where our ecosystems are right now, they're heavily degraded. We've lost a huge proportion of the species which should be in them, and the species which are in them are not necessarily species which are native to these ecosystems. They're species which have been introduced maybe from mainland Europe or maybe from other countries. Rhododendron is also in the top 20 list, and that's a really serious concern to the UK government because we spent nearly 4 million on it between 2015 and 2022. So just on rhododendron control, like keeping these species under control to stop them from spreading across the habitat and basically like swamping the entire habitat is a real issue for landowners. Things like sycamore, technically you can get timber out of sycamore, but when the sycamore are present in a woodland, what they tend to do is as soon as there's a gap in the canopy, the sycamore are the first to appear, and they take over that section of the woodland much faster than any other tree. And because they got kind of big shade-inducing leaves, they'll kind of shade out the forest floor below, which means there's not as much biodiversity in those patches as there could be. And you tend to end up with a near monoculture of sycamore in some places. And if you look at some of the British woodlands where this is happening, I mean, literally the woods just up the hill from me is happening. There's sycamore everywhere. And there's a woodland which has been surveyed in Oxfordshire where it's, you know, over 50% of the trees are sycamore in one survey, sort of over a certain height.
Chris, you talk about the sycamore being non-native. How long does a tree have to exist in Britain before it can be considered native?
The point about the distinction between native and non-native trees is that the native species in the UK are the ones which have existed in the UK for thousands, tens of thousands of years. And they have evolved alongside the other organisms which are in these ecosystems. So they've evolved alongside the moths, alongside, you know, the worms, alongside the fungi. And they've created these kind of beneficial relationships. And I talk about it in terms of like, you know, you've got a friend who you've just met. You might have kind of one or two things you have in common, but if you could know someone for years and years and years, you've got lots of in-jokes, you've got lots of kind of like things which you have in common, and these kind of connections build up over time. And it's the same with trees and organisms within an ecosystem. You just get lots and lots of sort of this, you know, this web of interactions which forms over a really long period of time. And when you get a new tree species, a new invasive species, a new kind of non-native species which comes into that ecosystem, the problem with it is that it doesn't have those inbuilt relationships. So it doesn't provide the food resources, and it doesn't create the kind of boost in abundance of the other organisms which are found around that habitat. But the other problem is that you also get this effect of like, because those other organisms can't eat it, maybe like with rhododendron, you get the invasive species comes in and takes over because nothing can eat it. And, you know, it can take over the habitat much faster than the other plants around it.
Now, you've used the National Biodiversity Network to investigate the species records and come to that conclusion. What is that? And is it something that's available to everyone?
Yeah, the National Biodiversity Network is a fantastic resource. And there's an atlas component of it as well. It basically compiles huge amounts of open source and other data sets, including things like iNaturalist, which is, you know, iNaturalist is an app which you can use to go out and record things yourself. And it's something which I use with my son. We love going out and recording, you know, insects and trees and things like that. And it also includes things like county records of birds and just specific species surveys of things like maybe churchyard yews or things like that, which go back to, you know, 1870s or whatever. It's this massive database of all these species records, which is sort of pulled together in one place. And it's a really useful place where you can do research into like what species are in this area, what species have historically been in this area. And you can sort of draw line, you know, you can draw circles on maps and say what has been here or what's been here between these periods of time.
Now, this week sees the launch of your new project, Life to Land, which is a landowner portal that aims to provide clear and detailed nature recovery advice. What sort of information does your portal provide?
Life to Land is trying to, the project's, the point of it is to democratize access to ecology information. And when you're a landowner, you might look at your land and kind of wonder what on earth is really going on in terms of the biodiversity there and how you can restore nature on it. The point of Life to Land is to connect you to the information which will make it easier to understand what's going on, what the processes are. And once you understand those kind of core processes, then it's much easier to work out what cost-effective interventions you can make in order to improve the biodiversity. So there are suggestions for things which you might do to improve the biodiversity. But it's also this process of learning where, like, the more you understand the ecology, the more you understand what's going on, the easier it is for you to go, oh, well, because I understand this, I can now make this kind of logical leap and go, well, this will probably work. You know, I've got this machine lying around. And because this, you know, because I'm traveling around in the soil creates diversity because of soil disturbance, then maybe I can use this machine which I have, which can create soil disturbance, and that might create biodiversity as well. It's this, once you have this kind of baseline understanding of ecology, it gives you the tools, you know, the mental tools to be able to make sort of logical leaps and help yourself more cost effectively.
Presumably you're drawing on information from sources like the National Biodiversity Network, but to use that network search tool, you really need to know what it is that you're looking for before you start. So what level of knowledge do you need in order to get information and value out of your Life to Land portal?
The point about the Life to Land portal is it's built for users with content from easy levels to medium to intermediate to hard. So there is a real sort of gradient. So there's a 45-minute lecture which people can view right at the beginning, which is basically like a real grounding for complete beginners to ecology, which runs you through the 3Ds, which is my kind of way of looking at ecological systems and kind of understanding how they work. But there's lots of other guides in there as well. So it depends on how you sort of want to access information, because a lot of different people access information in different ways. They want to read it, they want to listen, they want to watch videos. So I try to provide for each level of understanding. The NBN data, you can access it on a map. You can access that via search tools. It is a bit difficult to access some of the time. And there are easier search tools like on iNaturalist, you can also do similar things where you can search for species within a radius, and being on an app, that's usually more accessible for people.
And what else does the portal provide? What sort of services are there? Because looking at it from my own perspective, it looks like it's drawing together a range of data and information and presenting it in a really sort of user-friendly fashion.
Yeah, one of the things which is present there is there's a tree list, a butterfly list, and a bird list. And the tree list can be useful just in terms of identifying trees which might be useful to plant on your land. But the other thing as well is you can tick trees which are present, you can tick butterflies and birds which are present, and that gives you an idea of what the species diversity is like at a set point in time. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to allow people to sort of cache that information for a specific year, for 2024, and then monitor how it changes over time. So it will give you a kind of rough idea of how the biodiversity is improving or changing over time in response to the interventions which you're doing. So it's not just a system for learning about how biodiversity works. It's also a system for learning about how the biodiversity on your specific plot of land is changing and why it might be evolving.
And just finally, how do you expect the portal and the services it delivers to develop over time?
They're evolving from day to day, from week to week. I've just added a new magazine content section because I realise that people are interested in, you know, reading interesting content, not just accessing the portal for information and guides. So every day, every week, I'm adding new bits and changing things and trying to make it more user-friendly.
That was Chris de Gorn from Life to Land. Hugh Evans from Three Paws Farm in Abergavenny in Wales recently visited the Welsh Government's Sustainable Farming Scheme Consultation Roadshow. The consultation has now closed, but afterwards he wrote an article which appears on the 8.9 website called Embrace the Canopy. I asked Hugh why he thinks that farmers should learn to love woodland.
Woodland has loads of functions and, if designed correctly, can add to the productivity and profitability of a farming system. Some examples would be shelter in winter. You'll notice in the winter, livestock go and huddle by the hedge. Even if it's not got leaves on, it's providing shelter. In the summer, if you've got infield trees, you'll see all the livestock go and sit in the shade. Those health benefits are going to improve the productivity of those animals.
Hugh, can you describe your own setup and tell us how much woodland you have on your farm?
So we use permaculture design here at Three Paws. This is quite a people-centric farming design. So starting from the house, next to the house, we've got the veg systems, a bit further away, more orchard systems. And then further away from that again, we've got the sheep and the cows moving in loops around the fields, while the pigs are moving through scrubby loops that connect different patches of woodland. So it's a mosaic around the farm. Having a mosaic across the landscape is quite important ecologically. On the farm, when we moved here, there was 13% woodland and we planted an extra 4%. So we're now at 17% woodland. In terms of the subsidy is looking at canopy, not just total woodland. So you can find out how much woodland you've got quite easily. Working out your canopy is a bit more difficult because the canopy is looking at hedgerow trees and it is looking at infield trees. And they are actually very helpful from a production sort of view.
Now, you say that when you moved to the farm, there was already 13% woodland cover. Do you have a sense of how that previous farmer approached woodland and agriculture? Were they agroecological or mainstream in their approach?
He did some slightly odd things and some really good things. There's two patches of ancient woodland, and then I met the guy that worked with him to design the woodland planting that he did. So one of the things he did was planted a strip that runs up the hill and connects the two ancient woodlands. Connecting habitats is very important ecologically. For example, there's like one type of butterfly that it will fly 50 meters out of its habitat to look for a suitable habitat. And if it doesn't find it, it will fly 50 meters back, even if it was only 5 meters away from reaching suitable habitat. So linking habitats, very important for stopping the islanding effect that stops species from spreading. This planting is also then a boundary on the farm. So it improves our biodiversity because it stops nose-to-nose contact with neighbouring livestock. Then other plantings he did, he planted a woodland just north of the main farm area. So that stops our northerly winds. So there's benefits to that. It stops cooling of the house. It's also a visual barrier from the main road. And we run events, it's also a noise barrier from our nearest neighbours. So there's, in permaculture, we talk about the idea of stacking functions. So a woodland can achieve many different things.
You talk about that 13% that existed when you arrived, which is already 3% above the new requirement, but then you decided to add more. Why did you do that? What's the purpose of the additional 4% of woodland?
Multifunctional. I've just talked about stacking functions. So one, planting. We recently planted a vineyard, and so we planted a woodland just to the west of it because our predominant wind is coming from the west, so it's acting as a shelter belt for the vineyard. Within that planting, we put a high concentration of willow. Two reasons. One is the theory that if you chip willow and put it under soft fruit, then as the salicylic acid vaporizes it, it stops mildew forming on the soft fruit. The other reason being I love feeding willow to livestock. Anthelmintic properties, so it's a wormer. It's also very good at mineralizing cobalt, which we're very low in our soils here. The other woodland area we planted was on the northern edge, so we want to stop those northerly winds coming in and give more shelter to our livestock over winter.
Now, there's a lot of anger about the Welsh Government's proposed requirement for an increase to 10% of woodland on each farm. Where do you think that anger comes from?
I think that anger, it's become focused in on the woodland, but it's bigger than that. There's a change to the subsidy system, and in an industry where the average age is relatively high, approaching retirement age, you're then asking an industry that's not ready for it to completely redesign their farming businesses. Why is it at Woodland? It's because that's like a very simple thing to understand. It is clear that if you take this land that was once considered productive under the old labelling and make it unproductive according to the old labelling without fully explaining why it has value, it's very easy to get angry at.
Your approach is to combine woodland and livestock. What are the key benefits of doing this?
The benefits to keeping livestock in and around woodland: shelter, both from the sun and the wind. You can see your livestock hiding behind the hedge when it's bad weather. You can see the livestock hiding in the shade when it's sunny. The stress of either too hot or too cold is going to affect the animal's health. And if you can improve the animal's health and well-being, they're going to grow better. They're going to need fewer inputs to maintain condition. That's going to have production and profitability benefits. Then they're also going to be browsing on the leaves of the trees. That's going to provide trace elements. It's the equivalent of if you only ate one thing, or if you ate lots of a diverse diet, you're going to be much healthier if you're eating a diverse diet.
Now, you're a farmer, but your land holding is quite diversified with events and glamping as well as livestock. Do you think that more farmers should be looking to diversify their income streams?
Diversifying your income stream is definitely an option. Each farm is completely different, so how it diversifies will be different. Agritourism is a massive opportunity, but there's a risk of that becoming oversaturated. There's a lot of craft producers now who are looking for space. With the internet and remote working, there's also lots of opportunities there. With having woodland on farm, there's even forest schools, craft workshops, kind of stuff that make use of woodland. Bringing people onto land is a great way of seeing revenue come from a space. I talked about stacking functions earlier. Stacking function, even in a field, you can grow grass and you can have people come and spend time there, and that's double revenue from it.
That was Hugh Evans from Three Paws Farm. The UK's Department of Environment, Food and Rural Affairs is consulting on proposals for mandatory method of production labelling for some meat products sold in Britain. I spoke to Peter Stevenson and Catherine Jadav from Compassion in World Farming and started by asking Catherine what exactly the government is proposing.
It's proposing to put a label on meat, much like we have with eggs, that tells us how the animals were kept. So with eggs, we have, it's compulsory for the eggs to say whether they're from caged hens or barn or free range or organic. But we don't have that with meat products or dairy.
Will this be for all meat products?
Initially, they're going to start with chicken and pork products. So bacon, ham, sausages. And then they're going to look at rolling it out to other meat products as well and to dairy.
Why is method of production labelling necessary in the first place?
The method of production gives consumers obviously a clear idea of how the animals have lived, how they're raised. It's a very good indicator of the welfare that the animals have enjoyed. So it will tell consumers, has this animal spent the whole of its life indoors in very cramped, barren conditions, or has it alternatively been indoors but in rather good conditions? And best of all, has this animal been kept and lived free range outdoors?
It's important because we know that people want to know how the animals were kept. For example, a poll done last year found that over 80% of people thought that there should be labelling on meat products to say how the animals have been kept.
Now, of course, customers often say that they'll pay more for products from higher welfare farm system, but what's the evidence that they'll actually pay more?
Interestingly, when it became law that eggs had to be labelled according to how the hens had been kept, the proportion of eggs being sold that were from cage-free hens has just gradually increased quite dramatically. So it's gone from around 30% of eggs being sold that were from cage-free hens up to nearly 80% today.
In the case of eggs, for 20 years now, EU law, which is still applying here in the UK, requires egg packs to be labelled as the farming method. The pack's got to say eggs from caged hens, barn eggs, free range or organic. And that labelling has led to a huge shift away from cage eggs to free range, even though they cost more. Now, not all consumers are going to be willing to pay more or even able to pay more, but a pretty large chunk will pay more if they're told how the animal has been raised.
And why is the mandatory element important rather than, for example, voluntary labelling? And are there examples of this sort of labelling already in place in the UK or the rest of Europe apart from on eggs?
No, it's only with eggs that we have mandatory labelling. And the point about mandatory is that it means that not just the good eggs or meat have to be labelled, you know, free range, organic, whatever, but the bog standard factory farmed meat, eggs, milk have to be labelled as such. And that means from the consumer, when they pick up a pack saying eggs from caged hens or the equivalent that we hopefully now are going to get for pork and meat, chickens, they look at this and think, no, I don't feel comfortable about this. I'm going to go to something better. So the mandatory is absolutely crucial.
So the mandatory bit is really key, because if it's not mandatory, then we're in the same situation that we currently are, where we can choose to put a label on. And of course, those farmers that are producing to higher standards and giving their animals outdoor access, so free range or organic, they will put the label on. But the animals that are being produced to the intensive low welfare standards aren't going to say on the label indoor.
Why is it, do you think, that the government is starting with chicken and pork and not just moving ahead with all meat products?
In fairness to DEFRA, I think they're taking this step by step, and the big problem areas are with pigs, chickens and other poultry. These are the creatures that are, you know, most commonly factory farms. It's a good starting point. We need to quickly, though, move over to dairy, to milk, butter, cheese. It's a huge problem area for consumers. Governments rightly say consumers have to play their part in driving welfare improvements. But so far, apart from with eggs, consumers are, to a large degree, kept in the dark, particularly with dairy. When you pick up, you know, milk, butter or cheese in the supermarket, unless you can afford organic, you don't know whether this is coming from cows that have been kept outdoors on pasture in the grass growing season or from very intensive zero grazed herds. So DEFRA, yes, moved pretty quickly over to dairy as well.
We do already have voluntary labelling by farm system for pork products, so outdoor bred, outdoor reared. What difference do you think a mandatory label will make here?
What it's going to do, remember the outdoor bred and reared with pigs, it's only a small proportion of the overall pig sector. What the mandatory label will do is firstly tell consumers when the pig that's produced this meat has been reared intensively indoors. It will also, DEFRA's got about five different grades, and it will allow those farmers who are doing quite a lot to help, for example, not using farrowing crates, but are still an indoor system, to show that they are doing something better than the bog standard factory farmed, even though they've not actually gone free range. And I think that's really important.
How would you expect this to affect the marketplace?
I think this is really going to benefit those farmers who already are or wanting to move to higher welfare systems. It will allow them to show that they are farming to, you know, a good method of production. It means that those farmers who are still using bog standard factory farming will be distinguished in the marketplace. And, you know, when you link this with the fact that DEFRA is moving our subsidies over to rewarding for, amongst other things, high welfare, this could really be a game changer, because the farmer will both be getting some government subsidies support for higher welfare, and hopefully getting, you know, a better margin in the marketplace, because consumers will be moving over to these higher welfare products.
That was Peter Stevenson and Catherine Jadaf from Compassion and World Farming, bringing us to the end of this programme. I'd like to thank all my guests. I hope you've enjoyed the conversations, and if you have, please take a moment to share our content and do get in touch if you've got news to share. More, as ever, on our website, 8.9.com. I've been Finlow Castain. Bye for now.